This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. Quote, to see the invisible is to hear silence, and to hear silence is to see the invisible. Keep listening, listening attentively, listening patiently. What do you hear? What do you not hear? Nothing, perhaps. Silence, perhaps. What does hearing silence sound like? Does hearing silence mute silence? We have killed God by having forgotten how to hear silence. But if to hear silence is to silence silence, then the death of God is unavoidable. The question that remains is whether there is another silence, a deeper silence, a silence beyond silence yet to be heard in the stillness that surpasses understanding. So says the guest who joins me today on Entitled Opinions. We haven't heard that one in a while. Silence Must Be Heard, the theme song of this radio program in its earlier years. And how appropriate that it comes from a band named Enigma. There is something deeply enigmatic about silence, and also at times terrifying, as in the eternal silence of these infinite spaces. Compared to what we know today, Pascal had only an inkling of just how infinite cosmic spaces are and just how absolute their silence is. Chet Ramo, one of the great science writers of our time, reminds us, I quote, "There are no voices in the burning bush of the galaxy. The Milky Way flows across the dark shoals of the summer sky without an audible ripple. Stars blow themselves to smithereens. We hear nothing. Millions of solar systems are sucked into black holes at the center of galaxies. They fall like feathers. The universe fattens and swells in a big bang, a fireball of creation exploding from a pinprick of infinite energy. There is no soundtrack." Humankind cannot bear very much silence of this sort. That's probably why we flood our nature and outer space shows with unrelenting music. Silence is a kind of death for us, yet being, and with it music as well as human language, originate in the depths of that silence to which notes and words must constantly return for their articulation. As the French composer Marin Marais put it, "Toute note doit finir en mourant." Every note must end dying. Only by dying into silence and only by coming forth from it do notes sound at all. And likewise with our words, which are born from and die into silence. If death is the mother of beauty, and if from her alone shall come fulfillment to our dreams, Wallace Stevens, then silence is the mother of meaning, and from her alone shall come the saying power of words. To quote Ramo once again, "The silence of the stars is the silence of creation and recreation. It is the silence of that which cannot be named." Maybe it cannot be named, but silence can be heard, and in his new book, my guest, Mark Taylor, suggests that silence can be seen. Mark Taylor joined me recently for a show on his book Intervolution, and he returns to Entitled Opinions today to talk with me about silence and what he calls seeing silence, That's the title of another book of his published in 2020, Seeing Silence. Mark Taylor, welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
I'm delighted to be here, Robert.
Yeah. So I want to say, to start with, that we live in a world that seems to abhor silence. Our airports, stores, restaurants, supermarkets, hospitals are all drowned out by music. Our videos, televisions, and movies also. And if, God forbid, you wander into a pocket of silence somewhere, then out come the earbuds to deliver noise into your ear from the immense standing reserve of music, news, and podcasts that we carry around with us in our smartphones. It almost seems that the odyssey of world spirit culminates not in absolute knowledge, but in the great din of a world that no longer tolerates silence. And in your book, Mark, you mention, you actually quote Aldous Huxley on this phenomenon, where Huxley writes, I quote him, "The 20th century is the age of noise, physical noise, mental noise, and noise of desire. We hold history's record for all of them. And no wonder, for all the resources of our own almost miraculous technology have been thrown into the current assault against silence. That most popular and influential of all recent inventions, the radio, if he only knew, is nothing but a conduit through which prefabricated din can flow into our homes, and this din goes far deeper than the eardrums. It penetrates the mind, filling it with a babble of distractions, news items, mutually irrelevant bits of information, blasts of corybantic or sentimental music, continually repeated doses of drama that bring no catharsis, but merely create a craving for daily and even hourly emotional enemas. The noise of advertisement is carried from the ears through the realms of fantasy, knowledge, and feeling to the ego's central core of wish and desire. Spoken or printed, broadcast over the ether or on wood pulp, all advertising copy has but one purpose: to prevent the will from ever achieving silence." End quote. So my first question to you, Mark, today is, do you agree with me that we still belong to what Huxley called the age of noise, and that with the rise of digital technologies and social media and other more recent inventions, our age is far noisier today than when he wrote those words in 1945?
Absolutely. Noise has become much more intense as the technologies have become much more extensive and intensive. It's important to remember when Huxley was writing. It was 1945 he wrote that text, and it's extraordinarily prescient. The first half of the 20th century was a period during which noise increased considerably. Three of the main tendencies, obviously two world wars, but also industrialization and modernization, both carried with them a great increase in noise as there was a move from an agrarian to an industrial society. And for many, and among them some of the artists like Italian futurists, like Marinetti and the like, noise became a sign or a signal of modernization and modernity. So there was a veneration of noise. With the proliferation of some of the technologies developed during the Second World War, like radio and television, as the text suggests, there's a spread of noise and interference as advertising, again, as Huxley cites, becomes much more pervasive. And in the years since he wrote that text, new technologies have made this kind of use of noise for advertising much, much more extensive. So there's been a commercialization of noise that has led in some instances to a concern about silence or the lack of silence.
Now, I'm not a big, you know, mystic of silence. I understand to a certain extent Marinetti's logic by which noise is a sign of vitality. I mean, we know that most of humanity's history, our forebears lived in a kind of silence, which is unimaginable to us. Yet in moments of the flourishing of civilizations, like in ancient Rome, apparently, you know, with the cobblestones and so forth, and the carts and the horses and the chariots, apparently there was a kind of clatter and din that was really quite substantial day and night. But nevertheless, that's really the exception. And you speak about a silence that may be beneath the kind of silence of the eardrums, and that you suggest that there is a source of sorts, if I can use that word, a silent source from which our human words, language, and meaningful verbalizations arise, and that somehow this this deeper layer of silence, which is under threat through the age of noise, is something that we have to make very deliberate efforts to reconnect with.
Yeah, so I agree. There, and that is an element or a dimension that is regarded in various religious and even philosophical traditions as having a mystical component to that, and we can come back to that. Indeed, one of the most memorable and often cited quotations on silence was from Wittgenstein, where he wrote in Tractatus, "Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must remain silent." What's often overlooked and rarely cited is a sentence that follows shortly thereafter, where he writes, "There is indeed the inexpressible. It shows itself. It is the mystical." Now, Wittgenstein was an interesting figure in countless ways, but his concerns were not only with writing, which were extraordinarily influential, but also with art and particularly with architecture. And he withdrew for many years to a hut in Norway, where he lived in absolute solitude and absolute silence in search of all this. So there is this religious or mystical dimension to silence to which you refer and to which we can come back. But the more you ponder silence, the more complicated and multifaceted it becomes. It's not only a religious and philosophical issue. It's a social issue. It's a political issue. It's a psychological issue. And when we look at the world of today, the noise is not simply a function of the technology, though it is that to a large degree. It's political. It's political. And dictators, after all, dictate. I mean, the use of media and the constant bombardment through the media is a way of controlling and repressing as well. But there are also different modalities of silence. So
can I make a point about the political?
Yeah, sure.
Just to intervene for a moment, because what you say also reminds me of Hannah Arendt and her theory of propaganda. Right. Where she was speaking about totalitarian regimes, where the primary objective of all totalitarian regimes, especially when they take power initially, is to drown out the silence, which is a medium in which thinking takes place.
Correct.
And therefore, the propaganda is constant, it's 24/7, and it's broadcast everywhere. And in North Korea today, still, you will hear this going on. You can't even withdraw, physically speaking, into your own house and not hear the constant din of the propaganda in order to precisely militate against thinking. Because thinking is a political threat. So yes, but now when you mentioned that we're in an age where this noise has a political substrate, which is true, in our democracies, are you equating that kind of noise with things like nonsense and overdrive of news and a cacophony of voices that
are
chaotic?
Yes, of course. And that noise and cacophony is enacted for different reasons, some commercial, some political, and the like. But again, silence can be used, as you're suggesting, as a mode of repression. It's used in torture, right? But silence can also be used as a mode of resistance. It's multifaceted. Silence can be used as a form of punishment or a form of thinking and contemplation, as you suggest. There's a difference between the cell of a prisoner and the cell of a monk, right? Silence works in both places. And if you think about the role we talked about, you mentioned God, and we can come back to the theological if we like, but think of the role of silence in psychotherapy, right? It's precisely through not speaking, allowing another to speak, that a certain kind of disclosure and revelation comes about. The most important issue, it seems to me, and this gets at part of what you were talking about with this extra dimensional silence. Silence and language are not opposites. They're implicated in each other. They're folded into each other. And there's a linguistic dimension to that, but there's also, as you suggested, and as your opening quotations suggested, there's a cosmological and an ontological dimension to this, if you will. I mean, we come from and return to silence. It is that from which we come and toward which we are all moving. And in between, silence is in between. That is to say, silence is interstitial. It's liminal, right? It's the articulation that allows differentiation to occur, and therefore that allows language. So there is no language without silence.
Right. Well, that's certainly a case that you make strongly, and other people have done so, a number of them. I mean, Heidegger comes to mind. Heidegger. Also, Max Picard, he has a book called The World of Silence, which insists maybe a little bit too much on that point, that silence is originary. It's from the place from which things originate. So, but let's talk a bit about your title, because we talked about hearing silence, and that could be interpreted as a certain kind of attentiveness, a listening, an active listening. But the title of your book, published by Chicago University Press, came out last year, is called Seeing Silence. And a lot of it has to do with visual art. Right. And in your first or second chapter, you also recount uncovering with your brother after the death of your parents in an attic a whole crate of old pictures in black and white of people whom neither you nor your brother had any idea who they were, and almost everyone who would have been alive at the time is already dead, and that these pictures are looking at you with a kind of eloquent silence that I think that you even suggested that the primary motive for your book came from these pictures. Is that right?
Yes. So let me address the photographs first, and then the broader question of visual arts are obviously related. My brother and I were cleaning out the house, the only house my parents ever owned and the house in which we had grown up, after the death of my father. My mother had died 4 years earlier. And we worked our way sort of from the cellar to the attic, and we were in the attic, which stores many secrets, of course. And my father was quite an accomplished amateur photographer, and indeed taught me photographs, photography when I was young, and I worked several summers as a photographer. And we came across, in addition to boxes of slides that we from family trips and the like, this collection of older photographs, half of them black and white, half of them sepia. And neither my brother nor I knew any of the people. And yet they were all people who, for one reason or another, it was obvious, had been important to my parents. And by this time, most of the siblings were dead. And we had no idea who these people were. We had no one to ask about them. I mean, one of the things that I write in the book is that nothing seals death more than questions you can no longer ask. There was nobody to ask these questions. And yet they were friends. They were obviously from, many of them from my mother's hometown, which is a coal mining town in Pennsylvania. And they were pictures of some miners. There were pictures of my great-grandparents. We were able to identify them. But you just became aware of how recent these deaths were, really, and how nothing is known about these. I often, in my classes, I will ask my students if they know the names of their four great-grandparents. And many of them do not. And then I will ask them, if they know their names, do they know what their great-grandparents did or anything about them? And they don't. So two generations, they're silent. It's not just a matter of forgetting, but in Maurice Blanchot's wonderful text called Oblivion, it's a matter of oblivion. And oblivion, as distinguished from forgetting, as I understand it, is forgetting that you've forgotten. Yeah. It's a complete obliteration, which is an absolute silence that death brings. And the photograph, in a certain way, captures that unspeakable absence. And so, and of course, the classic text on that is Roland Barthes' Camera Lucida, which is really a prolonged meditation on a photograph of his mother that he had found. But though there are multiple photographs in the book, that photograph is missing. Right? So that the photograph and death, and of course there's a long history of death masks, death photographs, the photograph is tied to death, which is also central to this whole meditation on silence.
And looking at the photos that are reproduced in the book, I understood what you meant by seeing silence, which is an oxymoron, oxymoron, it's synesthesia. Right. But there's something about especially human figures as opposed to landscapes, which we're accustomed to seeing as silent places. There's something about bygone human beings in their images, which makes the silence of the photograph resound with enigma, and it's a sense of
which is the name of the band that you
that's right
mentioned that that's
right. That's right.
And of course these photographs are mirrors in which we see our own selves, the anticipation of our own selves in that way.
Well, it's also a revelation that silence is what death the correlation between silence and death is made evident. It's shown in these photographs because that's what death leads us to, is to a kind of silence. This oblivion and you know, that sound, what we hear, takes place in time, in the very finite mortal time that we live in. But those photographs and other artworks, you know, are reminders that there's a penumbra that surrounds the moments of presence that we...
Right. So to go back to the other aspect of the question you asked, I mean, why frame a meditation on silence in terms of visual artists? As you say, it's oxymoronic. And there are multiple reasons for that. I actually structured the book in terms of Stations of the Cross. There are 14 one chapter zero, and looked at 12 or 13 different artists because the visual work of art is after all silent, it's a painting or a sculpture or whatever. But it's part of a larger problematic that I've wrestled with over the years. In that second phrase of Wittgenstein already, he says there is indeed the inexpressible. This shows itself. I mean, this notion of a certain kind of performative. I mean, how can you say silence? How can you make silence? It's the same as in the text that you read. You said you hear nothing. How do you hear nothing? Right? How do you see absence? And there are ways in which, in order to do that, one must make language performative. I mean, Heidegger, to whom you've referred, talks about poesis. I mean, this whole notion in Heidegger of Aletheia, it's a showing by hiding. I mean, the interrelationship between revealing and concealing is inseparable between language and that which is inarticulate. How do you represent what cannot be represented? This is Beckett's problem. I mean, one of the greatest meditations on silence I know is the unnameable.
Yeah. Right?
You know, how does one name the unnameable? Now, part of what is done in literary texts like Beckett, that's is to make language performative of that which language cannot say, right? Say or say directly. But that, after all, is a theological problem.
So would it also okay, it applies to visual arts. We'll talk more about that, but I want to make sure that John Cage gets into the discussion because he was trying to make music. It's even more paradoxical in his case because music is definitely a sonorous medium, and he was trying to make connect music to silence and to incorporate silence into music. Do you see that strong link between Beckett and John Cage in their aesthetic
styling? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And not only Beckett and John Cage, but, Cage was deeply, deeply involved with other artists at the time, in particular, particularly Robert Rauschenberg. And Rauschenberg had done a whole series of white monochromatic paintings. And this issue of monochromatic painting is one that recurs throughout the book, and we talk about that more. And people like Ed Reinhardt, who was a close friend and associate of Thomas Merton, or in Mark Rothko and Rothko's Chapel. I mean, the use of monochromatic painting. But at the time that he was working on this issue of silence, which eventually became his famous, what shall we call it, performance of 4.33, which was basically a performance in which a person comes out, sits in front of a piano, does nothing for four minutes and 33 seconds. Now, what was Cage trying to do there? Was he trying to make you hear silence, or was he trying to get you to realize the impossibility of hearing silence? Because once there is that complete silence, and of course, initially when this was done, people didn't know. People weren't, this is the last thing they expected. So there's restlessness, and then you begin to hear ambient noise at this time. But Cage was preoccupied with this, and he also spent time in Japan and was quite taken with Zen rock gardens, and has done a whole series of drawings. Indeed, I used one of those drawings in the cover of Seeing Silence. So there was an intersection of this visual and the verbal, or the lack of the verbal, that was going on with Cage. He then did a book entitled Silence, and one half is called On Being, one half is called On Nothing, a lecture on nothing, which, of course, is the first chapter of Hegel's Logic.
Right, right. And speaking of nothing, there's also his famous saying that I have nothing to say and I'm saying it, and that is poetry. Right. There is a kind of poetry that can bring silence out in through the word. And I think
there's often an interesting interrelationship between the verbal and the visual in some of these texts. One of the writers I was fortunate enough to know pretty well, and I greatly admire, is Edmond Jabez, who was a poet. He was from Egypt, but spent most of his life in Paris. He was in exile there. And he wrote eloquently on silence. He says that he has one book called The Book of Questions. And the last volume of that is really a meditation on silence. He says in that text, silence is not the weakness of language. It is, on the contrary, its strength. It is the weakness of language not to know this. And what's interesting about Jabez's text is, in its printed form, it uses the black and white of the page and the spatial layout as a way of trying to express speech and silence. So it's an interplay of white space and black space. You take somebody like Ed Reinhardt and Mark Rothko, the monochromatic painting that seeks to allow you to see silence is black or complicated shades of that. If you look at Cage, if you look at Rauschenberg, Agnes Martin, others, you have the blankness being white. But where what's interesting to me really happens isn't in either the black or the white, but their interplay. It's their interconnection, because silence is liminal. It takes you to the edge It is that within language that allows language to be articulated but can never be expressed linguistically.
Yeah, and it's all this seems to have a Mallarmean inspiration, totally. Where Mallarmé was definitely looking for the black and white, and where the silence, where he could bring his poem to the edge of that silence, that liminal mm-hmm. silence, that yeah, for sure.
Well, the other figure in this who's been important for me, I mean, it's where my work began, is Kierkegaard. And, you know, certainly his best known, and I think his best book is Fear and Trembling, which is in effect a meditation on silence. And if you come back to your theological question that you raised, and Kierkegaard says quite explicitly, and this is intriguing in terms of the political that you started with, silence can either be the mark of the deity, can either be divine or demonic. And, you know, for Kierkegaard, God is, in his terms, infinitely and qualitatively different, radically other. Now, how can that which is radically other speak? How can you hear that which is radically other? I mean, Freud's version of that is the unconscious, right? How can you hear that which language cannot express, contain, or represent? So both radical transcendence and, on the opposite end, a radical immanence, that which is completely within the world, that kind of undifferentiation, but that can't be articulated. That can't be articulated either. So that silence can be either figured, and the notion of figuring is interesting here, right? That can be figured either as void or as fullness, as emptiness or plenitude, and it's precisely either of those. But it's the interplay of those that is the silence beyond silence, or the silence beyond that which is simply the opposite of language.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you think about the notion of the divine or of God and gods, that I've mentioned this a few times before on Entitled Opinions, but there is a profound difference between the Judaic and the Greek notions of the divine, where the Hebrew God is the God of the voice. Mm. He's the God who speaks, and it takes place, therefore, in time, and the commandments, and the role that speaking plays in terms of the first thing, there's the prohibition against the representation, visual representation of the divine in Judaism, as opposed to the, you know, Greek religions, where you have all these theophanies. The gods have a habit of showing themselves, some often in human forms, and all the artworks that depict the gods, and even Plato's Metaphysics, which is a metaphysics of vision, and of theory, which is a word that has to do with seeing something, the forms, the eidos, all that heavy primacy on the visual, which sees things simultaneously. It doesn't need time for its unfolding. Whereas in the Hebrew scriptures, you have a historical God, precisely because it's a God who reveals himself through language in time and in history. So
you've left something out.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Christians.
I think that Christianity takes both traditions.
Correct, but therein lies a certain kind of difference. And the other aspect of all of this,
because there's an incarnation in the Christian, where there's an actual showing in the historical, but also in the visual sense, if you want to use a visual field.
Correct, but there is also within the Christian tradition, and not only, but within the Christian tradition, this very, very important strand of what's called negative theology.
Right.
That the only way in which you can talk about that which is wholly other is negatively. And there is in that whole tradition, of course, a strong mystical bent. You know, you look at Nicholas of Cusa or Pseudo Dionysus. I mean, the cloud of unknowing. I mean, the dark, you know, the darkness that is the light, paradoxically. I mean, what you say is completely true. But you know, if you look at Kierkegaard, for example, he is closer to the Judaism that you're correctly describing than many within the Christian tradition. Yeah. The other place in the Jewish tradition that I hesitate a little bit to think about this. And we should also talk about Buddhism, is the whole Kabbalistic tradition, where you have this whole kind of interplay between withdrawal and revealing, that, you know, the God shows himself, let's use that metaphor, by withdrawing into a point, right? The zitzum, right? Which is very, very close to the kind of thing that Heidegger sees going on with, you know, with his notion of truth.
Aletheia, yeah.
Aletheia, right?
Yeah, for sure. So we could go down this path for the rest of the show, but I think that a lot of our listeners will be particularly interested in your treatment of the modern artists that you were going on about. There's one I would like you to say more about, which is James Turrell, I'm pronouncing that last name correctly. James Turrell, who in a strange way kind of is related to the theme we were just discussing, because he is an artist of light, and what he does with light, light is interesting because it's not the image, it's not the represented thing. It's a medium by which things can be revealed. So, what role does Turrell play?
Turrell's an absolutely fascinating artist. One important thing to note in this context about Turrell is that he was raised Quaker, and that Quakerism remains very, very important to him. Now, of course, silence and light are the substance, as it were, of Quakerism. He went to Pomona and got involved with the art and technology movement in Southern California at the time, and really has made, as you suggest, light his medium. He's best known for what he calls skyscapes, in which he basically opens in a building, various kinds of buildings, creates an opening to the sky, and then creates ambient light around that building. And these structures are extraordinary. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to see several. I mean, his life's work is really a volcano called Rodin Crater, which is located 40 miles in the desert. And the desert's important in all this. If you go back to some of the mystics, as a place of withdrawal, of silence, of meditation, right? In the high desert in Arizona, in which he is carving out of this volcano what becomes one of these skyscrapes. So you enter, and there's a 935-foot tunnel at a 7-degree angle up to an opening in the volcano where he's crafted this room where you go and sit and look at the sky. And dawn and dusk are the best times. And it's extraordinary what happens there. I mean, I guarantee you that in looking at the sky through the skyscapes, you see colors you've never seen. And the astonishing thing is, if you go outside, it's not far to do, and look at the sky, it's a totally different color. So basically, what is he trying to do? He's trying to get, at one level, he's trying to allow you to see seeing. Yeah. That is to say, the world itself is not colored, right? Color is an interaction kind of event. And the range of colors that we see, of course, is very, very small compared to many animals and the like. But it's this absence, this opening, this clearing that allows seeing to occur. So there are ways in which that opening, and again, opening, clearing, those are Heideggerian categories. That opening or clearing is an articulation. If you go back to your notion of time, I mean, when I said in between, silence is in between, it's the spacing, and the spacing is a timing. If there isn't silence, there is no articulation of language. Everything's blurred together. The condition of the possibility of articulation, and the word is important, is this kind of spacing and timing that allows that void, that emptiness, that silence, that pause. I cannot say that too fast.
Well, it's true. And I go that quote from Madame Marais about every note in music should finish by dying.
That's right. Right.
That it's by drawing attention to its fading away, or it's drawing attention to the source out of which the note is able to sound at all and to resonate.
Right. And I want to circle back to that that point, because there was an issue in our last conversation that we never got to address adequately, as we were talking about technology as a way of curing all our ills, and that is mortality, and correlatively finitude. I mean, clearly in my own life and in my own thinking, the experience of illness, of death. You know, at this very moment, we're living through a person very, very close to us who's been wrestling with a brain tumor for 12 years, and for the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, has been completely wrapped in silence, but can't die, can neither live nor die. But, you know, as someone who, like you, as in Blanchot's phrase, died without dying, you confront silence. And as we age, and, you know, I'm moving toward the end of my career and the end of my life, there's a silence there. And I think when you go back to the questions with which you began, the ways in which noise, all of these technologies allow for distraction. I mean, that's what we are afraid of facing, of hearing silence.
Well, right, exactly, exactly. Because that what you're saying is that silence, the silence that comes from dying, doesn't just come at the end of a lifetime. It's something that you can be in relation with throughout your life as a mortal, and that you learn how to be a mortal by relating to that silence and realizing.
That's what that French phrase you quoted says.
Yeah.
You know, every note.
Every note should end dying. And it's something like Emerson that says that you find the journey's end in every step of the way. Mm-hmm. So as long as you remain related to the liminal silence, then when the time comes for the actual physical dying, you have already cultivated a kind of friendship. I don't know if friendship in the expansive sense of having created an intimacy with that which is in any case going to be, you know, the fons et origo, the actual source and origin of what life is. And then you can experience death not as a termination, but as a culmination of a life.
But it's also the case, you know, and there's another way of saying this. I mean, death is not an event that comes at the end of the life, as you're suggesting. It's a moment. It's part of every moment of life. But it's also the case, you know, that the silence is not only fatal, it's also generative. That is to say that that's what I said, we emerge from and return to that silence. And part of what it seems to me, this notion of detachment, which is another way of talking about or of letting go, it's in that very experience of letting go or detachment that you are in a certain sense freed. I mean, in my own experience, the experience of dying without dying was extraordinarily liberating in a strange sort of way, because it allows you to let go of the noise, of the distraction, the busyness. And
do you believe, Mark, that all these artists that you deal with and artists in general have to have that space of retreat and detachment and in order to produce the kind of eloquent silence in the visual realm?
I do. And that, you know, that when I split my time between New York City and the Berkshires, and I can't write in the city. I can only write. I can read in the city, but I can't write in the city, because I think that the cultivation of a certain kind of reflection. I mean, what you started by talking about is absolutely correct, that thinking is threatening. Thinking is threatening. And the kind of self-reflection that requires silence, that requires meditation. I mean, it is from that kind of reflection that I think creativity occurs. Not all writing is really writing. I mean, writing in the broad sense that I use involves this kind of creativity, because what you're trying to make language slip and slide, or you're trying to use, I mean, figures to figure what can't be figured, to allow a certain kind of experience to occur. I mean, I try to do that in some of the art that I create here in the Berkshires. I mean, how can you write differently, again, in a broad sense of that term, to enact that which cannot be represented and to create the occasion for the possibility of the viewer or reader to hear what can't be said?
Right. And so you've written that this could be considered like a reversal of Hegel, that rather than translating Vorstellung into Begriff or representation into concept, it's translating Begriff into Vorstellung.
Correct.
And what cannot be represented must be performed. And this is Wittgenstein's thing about showing, the difference between showing and telling, and how much more compelling is the act of showing than telling, and how much we live in also an era, if we're still in that age of noise that Huxley talked about. One of its manifestations is certainly the way in which all we try to drown out any kind of showing through excessive telling. No?
That's right.
We're always being told what to think. We're always being told what happened. We're drowning in explanations as opposed to revelations.
Exactly. And, you know, as I said in our previous show, my soul's strung between Hegel and Kierkegaard. I finally believe that there are things that we apprehend that we cannot comprehend. And apprehension is an interesting word, right? It's multiple nuances. So part of the question becomes, how do we communicate the apprehensive? How do we communicate what is conceptually elusive? Right? Now, you have to use language against language to show what language cannot say. And certainly, that's what Beckett's trying to do in his place. That's what Ingmar Bergman is trying to do, the great Swedish filmmaker who did this wonderful trilogy. One of the films is Silence. It's not didactic. It draws you in. And the artworks, whether it's literature or visual, I want an artwork to take me elsewhere. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I wrote in another book was, you know, once you've been elsewhere, you can never come back the same, because elsewhere always comes back with you. I mean, there's a haunting there. I mean, those figures in those photographs, they're silent, but somehow they still speak through you because you're haunted by those others. And that haunting at one and the same time enables you to be who you are, to say what you say, and yet realize that your words are never your own. They're never simply your own. There is always something other, something different, something that cannot be articulated speaking through you. Yeah. And it's a problem we face in teaching. I mean, how do you communicate that?
The incommunicable, yeah. And all this, you know, to conclude, reminds me of a line of Nietzsche's, if I'm going to quote it correctly, where he says, "It is my favorite malice and art that my silence has learned not to betray itself through reticence."
Correct. So, correct. Right. And I love the word betray, because it means multiple things, right? It go against, but also to show, like when you show it, betray a secret. And but the other thing, and it's perfect that you conclude with Nietzsche, because what more poignant example of what we've been talking about than Nietzsche, who at age 44 slips into madness and falls silent. And the greatest philosopher, one of the greatest, if not the greatest philosopher, late 19th, 20th century, spends his last years wrapped in silence.
Right, right. Well, Mark Taylor, we've been speaking with Professor Mark Taylor from Columbia University here on Entitled Opinions. This is our second show, first one aired a little while ago on Intervolution. I'm going to ask our listeners to check that show out as well, if you haven't already. And it's an ongoing conversation, Mark. Entretien infini, as you said before, and we're going to thank you for joining us. We're going to leave you with a song by Madeleine Boutin called A Sword in Hand, which is about an angel on the three steps of purgatory in Dante's purgatory who's going to induct him into, you know, along the way to the ultimate experience of the silent sublime. So thanks again for coming on.
These conversations have been a delight. Extraordinary level you maintain in this program.
Thank you. Well, to be continued.
To be continued. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The ocean pale and the skyline tall. Early calls of the morning cold. Find me. It's I'm gonna leave.